I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, my guest is the Catholic Archbishop of Baltimore, William E. Laurie. In August, the Attorney General of Pennsylvania released a scathing report detailing the sexual abuse of more than 1,000 children by Catholic priests. Pope Francis expressed shame and sorrow in his condemnation of the abuse, and he called for decisive action. But last week, the Vatican ordered the National Conference of Catholic Bishops to defer until next year measures to address the crisis. The Church continues its advocacy for the poor, its charitable work across the globe, and its pastoral mission with more than 1 billion faithful members. But that faith has been shaken by crimes and cover-ups that go back decades. Catholicism at the crossroads. Archbishop William E. Laurie joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with me. My guest today is the Catholic Archbishop of the Baltimore Diocese, Archbishop William E. Laurie. Last week, the National Conference of Catholic Bishops met, as they do every fall, here in Baltimore. Before the conference, there appeared to be support among the bishops for a number of actions that would address the continuing crisis of clergy sexual abuse. But after the Vatican ordered the bishops to refrain from taking any action or issuing any statements until an international synod is held next year, the bishops weren't able to agree on even an informal resolution. Archbishop Laurie was among those who reportedly pressed his colleagues for some kind of statement of consensus, perhaps, but to no avail. This left many Catholics and others deeply skeptical of the bishops' contention that they were doing everything they could to show compassion to the victims and demand accountability for their abusers. In August, the Pennsylvania Attorney General issued a report that was a result of a 2-year investigation into child sex abuse by Catholic clergy in 6 Pennsylvania dioceses. The extent of their findings was stunning. They found more than 300 priests had victimized more than 1,000 children, and the grand jury noted that it believed the actual number of victims was much higher. The grand jury also found that senior church officials knew about the abuse and routinely covered it up. The Office of the Maryland Attorney General has begun an investigation into abuse and cover-ups by the Maryland clergy. Archbishop Laurie has pledged the full cooperation of the Archdiocese in that review. We will take your calls a little bit later in the program, but in the meantime, you are welcome to send us an email or a tweet, or you can ping us on Facebook where we are streaming our conversation. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @midday_WYPR. Archbishop, it's nice to see you. Thanks for coming
Thank
in.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Tom.
So before the conference took place, the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, about a month before, you gave an interview to the Catholic Review, and you said that we have to take a day of reparation and penance. You were advocating a prayerful beginning to that meeting. I wonder if I could ask you a personal question about your own spiritual practice, in that when you have that conversation with God, when you're praying around this very difficult, complex, and stunning issue of sex abuse by the men who are in the church that you help lead, what is that conversation like? What does contrition look like in that prayerful moment?
You know, first of all, I think prayer is fundamental. Sometimes people say, you're just praying about it. But I think that seeking God's help and asking God's mercy are fundamental to addressing this crisis. So every day I spend quiet time in prayer. That's how I begin my day. Not a day goes by when this is not the subject of what I might call a personal conversation with God. I pray, first of all, to God, because I know that at some level this is beyond my ability to handle unaided. I ask if I might grow in some understanding of what it's like to experience this terrible thing called child abuse, sexual abuse. I recognize sometimes I pray for victims, specific victims. Sometimes I pray for the wisdom to be able to address it better. And sometimes I'm numb. I just give it to God. And I just say, I'm just here. And prayer can be consoling. But I do also think the Lord lets you hang out there sometimes, because he wants you to know, to understand, to feel what it is you're dealing with, and to certainly depend upon him, but also in depending upon the Lord, to find the courage and strength to do what is right.
Did the Vatican leave you hanging out this time when they disallowed a statement and you were a forceful advocate for having some sort of statement about this, and the boss said no?
Tom, it would be an understatement to say that the announcement by Cardinal DiNardo in the first moments of our meeting that we could not vote on these three important items took me by surprise. And so, yeah, wind out of sails, that's how you sort of feel sitting there. Nonetheless, within moments, I felt like I needed to get up and say to the leadership of the conference and my brother bishops, we might not be able to take a formal vote on this. That's true. But I wasn't trained by the Jesuits, but I've hung around enough Jesuits to make distinctions. And one distinction I made is, why don't we do an advisory vote? A sense of the House. And that, as you remarked in your opening comment, that didn't happen. But I will tell you this. In dealing or interacting with bishops, and I had many, many conversations over that past week, there's a lot of support for the things we had planned to do. There might be disagreement in the details, but in terms of an overall direction, there's tremendous support to hold ourselves accountable, to be transparent, to level the playing field between ourselves and priests, so that if we're accused, we are dealt with as a priest would be dealt with. If we have committed a crime, we are out. And if we have mishandled these cases, we need to be held accountable for that. And if we have sexually harassed an adult, particularly one in our charge, we need to be accountable.
Does that strong support indicate what some are considering a rift between U.S. bishops and Pope Francis?
I don't know if I would call it a rift. I would say, though, we're a global church. So I have to handle this in the Archdiocese of Baltimore, City of Baltimore, in 9 Maryland counties, 500,000 Catholics, 140 parishes, 400 priests, to get the idea. It's a big job. And it takes a lot of effort, not on my part alone, but on the part of my colleagues, to do this well and wisely. And believe you me, we give it a lot of attention every single week and every single day, if need be. Imagine doing it globally, across all the continents, across all the cultures, across people who have very different views of this than we do in the United States. Do I still wish he had let us vote on this? Of course I do. Is there some wisdom in letting these four proposals be made ripen a little bit and develop a little bit? Of course there is. We understood that they weren't totally ready for prime time. Is it a direction we ought to go in? I think it is. And I believe that when Cardinal DiNardo and the leadership of the conference goes to meet with the Pope in February, they're going to press these action steps that our people think are important. I've done 12 listening sessions around the Archdiocese of Baltimore, And a lot of people said, sure, you need to pray. Sure, you need to apologize, but we want action and action now.
Did Cardinal DiNardo or anybody from the conference speak to the Pope last week? Was anybody in a position to push back and say, Holy Father, this is the wrong call?
I don't know about last week, but I do know leading up to the meeting, Cardinal DiNardo and the conference leadership, we have the usual suspects and a president, vice president, et cetera, general secretary, went over and met with the Pope and shared at some point the documents that we were going to vote on, recognizing that we would have to get the approval for these things once we had taken the vote, just as we did back in the year 2002 when the bishops voted for the landmark charter and norms, which has really changed how we deal with sexual abuse in the life of the church. I was on the commission that went over to Rome to get approval for the charter and the norms. There's differences of view, differences of culture, sometimes different understandings about the finer points of canon law. It's a little like a legislative process. You go to conference, you iron out the details, but the fundamental direction remains. That's what I hope and pray happens here.
The different views, the different cultural considerations, there are those who think that once this ends up in this global conference that's happening in February in Rome, that because of the differences in cultures in other countries and on other continents, that in a certain way, the United States Catholic Church is way ahead mm-hmm. of Asia, is way ahead of places in Africa, is way ahead of other dioceses that, in terms of this problem of clergy sexual abuse. There's great concern that the proposals that you've alluded to, which include, for example, creating a national third-party reporting system or making sure there's a very clear code of conduct for bishops and a uniform standard for how to report credible allegations of abuse, that kind of thing, that will be watered down, that will be attenuated to some degree once it gets into a global forum.
I don't think we're going to go for the lowest common denominator, frankly. And I can certainly speak to what we're going to do locally and what we are doing locally. We're already doing those things in the Archdiocese of Baltimore. So if a complaint comes against myself or one of my auxiliary bishops, it doesn't come to my office. It comes to an ethics point, third-party reporting system. I have asked our review board to receive, our independent lay review board for sexual abuse matters, to receive that allegation. It goes to law enforcement. It would go to the nuncio, the Pope's representative in the United States. We've signed on to the code of conduct, which every diocese has, and it pertains to things, of course, sexual abuse, sexual harassment, etc. We're signed on to that. We're just as accountable as any of our priests, any of our employees, or even a volunteer.
And to whom are the bishops accountable? Because that seems to be, as I read about this issue and hear the various points of view, that the direction of the accountability is something kind of up in the air. I talked yesterday with a guy named David Lawrence, who's with mm-hmm. a group called SNAP, S-N-A-P, mm-hmm. Survivors Networks of People Who've Been Abused by Priests. Here's one of the things that he had to say about the review boards that you're alluding to.
Back in 2002, when they created these review boards, one of the aspects of the review board is that it would be independent and made of lay and lay-led. And John Paul II took that part out and said, clergy will never answer to the lay. Clergy always only answer to each other.
So Pope John Paul II, clergy will never answer to the lay people. Clergy will only answer to each other. What's your understanding?
I was over there when the charter and the norms got approved. Nothing like that was said. We have in Baltimore an excellent review board. It's made up of people with psychological background, law enforcement, all the appropriate competencies that are necessary. They know everything, any allegation that comes to us. I have always followed their direction. They're an excellent group, and that's true in the other dioceses where I have served. Do we answer to the Pope as bishops? Of course we do. Constitutive of the church is the Pope and the bishops, the College of Bishops gathered around him. But there's always people in between. There's a nuncio. There's the Congregation for Bishops. We think there needs to be an independent lay commission to help investigate crimes, to help investigate allegations or malfeasance on our part. That doesn't mean we don't answer to the Pope. That means we answer to the Pope with greater integrity. That's what this is about. That's what this is about.
Baltimore Archbishop William E. Laurie is my guest. He is the 16th Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Baltimore, which is the oldest diocese in the United States. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, Archbishop Laurie will be taking your calls, your emails, your tweets. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. And we are streaming our conversation on the WYPR Facebook page. Stick around. We will be right back. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, join us tomorrow for the annual Midday Pre-Thanksgiving Show. Chef John Shields of Gertrude's at the BMA and Chef David Thomas of Ida B's Table will be on hand to take your calls and quell any last-minute turkey anxiety and offer up tips for perfecting your Thanksgiving feast. Plus, it's Midday with my mom. My mom, Rosemary Hall, will discuss desserts and other things having to do with cooking for a crowd with Midday foodie Sasha Wohlhandler. So we look forward to having Midday with my mom and you tomorrow here on WYPR. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Baltimore Archbishop William E. Laurie. He is the former chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Doctrine, and he was instrumental in drafting a set of guidelines established for addressing allegations of sexual abuse of minors by Catholic clergy. It's called the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. You're welcome to join our conversation. We'll take as many calls as we can during the hour. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. And again, you can find us on the WYPR Facebook page. We're streaming our conversation. You can ping us there. Archbishop Laurie, when it comes to people who have been credibly accused of abuse, then there is this process, a review board, et cetera, to handle these claims. When it comes to this independent review board, you mentioned law enforcement is involved in the one that you've set up for the Archdiocese, but there are others involved as well. Again, Mr. Lawrence from SNAP yesterday talked about the independent review, and this is what he had to say.
It needs to be reviewed not by clerics, but by law enforcement. All of those records. It doesn't need to be out into the public. The review of the records does not need to be reviewed by the public with any abuse allegations. There's a certain amount of confidentiality there. I get it. But by the same token, a bishop or a cleric is not trained in investigative techniques. And those records should be reviewed by someone who's capable and trained in that area. So by a police officer or a retired police officer. And someone who doesn't have a tie or an investment in the Catholic Church. It has to be an independent review. In other words, somebody who's a good friend of the bishop or somebody who is a friend of a priest can't be objective.
It comes down to, you know, can any organization investigate itself? Mm-hmm. If there are people on the review boards and the commissions that you're talking about that are tied in some way or another to the Catholic Church, which is fully their right to be, can it be completely objective, and can it be completely, is that the most effective way?
So I think in this quote we just heard, there are two things going on. One is about allegations and the other is about records. With regard to allegations, when we get an allegation, we report it to law enforcement immediately, as soon as we get it. And we don't begin any internal investigation until law enforcement tells us it's okay to do so. In other words, it's not our job to interfere with law enforcement. And that investigation goes where it will. And at the same time, we're public about it if law enforcement allows us to be public about it. When we get the all clear from law enforcement, we do an investigation, but the thought that this is done by priests is simply not true. In our archdiocese, we have a team, and it is lay people. Qualified lay people who do this, who do have a background in these matters, and who do evaluate the claim and the credibility of the claim and what ought to be done. Then and only then does it go to the review board. And yes, I know the people on the review board, but they are not 13 or 14 of my closest friends. These are people who have nothing to gain by colluding with me. These are people that have reputations in the community. They're former judges or sitting judges. They are law enforcement. They are people with backgrounds in behavioral sciences. They run major institutions. And they look over my shoulder and over the shoulder of my coworkers to see if we've done it right. And if we've not done it right, if we missed a step, if we perhaps didn't understand the situation as profoundly as we should have, they send us back to the drawing board.
We have a number of emails, we have a number of calls, and I want to get to them. But again, on this matter of accountability, and you talk about not interfering with law enforcement, and of course everyone applauds that. But in terms of what the bishops can do themselves to hold their fellow colleagues accountable, to hold priests accountable. I was astonished to read in the report by the Pennsylvania Attorney General about Bishop James Timlin. Mm-hmm. He's a senior member of the church. He's 91 years old. He was at the conference last week. Mm-hmm. He's the former head of the Diocese of Scranton, Pennsylvania. And he oversaw a priest, a man named Thomas Skotek, who raped a young girl, got her pregnant, and then arranged an abortion. He wrote a letter and he said, "This is a very difficult time in your life, and I realize how upset you are. I, too, share your grief." But he didn't send that letter to the young woman. He sent that letter to Mr. Skotek. He's been removed from the Archdiocese of Scranton, but he's not been stripped of his priestly duties. There was a press release that came out that said he'll no longer represent the diocese at public events. I mean, people hear that and they think there's just no accountability or very limited accountability when it comes to what the bishops can do outside of law enforcement.
One of the things we want to get clear on, and it's one of the things we would have considered more closely at the meeting we just had, is what can a diocesan bishop do with his successor who has really handled these cases in a way that is reprehensible, and what you describe is reprehensible. Options are pretty limited. I think Bishop Bambera, who's the current Bishop of Scranton, did what he could. I believe we are urging the Holy See and the Vatican to be much more stringent with those who have committed malfeasance in office. We want to see that, for example, with Archbishop McCarrick.
Mm-hmm. In Washington.
Who in many ways epitomizes this whole crisis. Everyone wants to know, how did he rise so high up in the hierarchy?
He had been sanctioned way back by Pope Benedict.
So we think.
Yeah.
And now he's in a monastery out in Kansas someplace. But many of us want to see a much more thorough investigation.
Like, is that the kind of thing that the Council of Bishops could, the Conference of Bishops could vote to recommend that Cardinal McCarrick be stripped of his priestly authority, for example?
Probably not. We're not a legislative body. It looks like a Congress. It acts like a Congress. It quacks like a Congress. But it's not one. It's really more like a trade organization, to put it in layman's terms. Seems to me, though, that a lot of us bishops would like to see that done. And we certainly would like to see a full accounting of what happened. We would like to see that, and we'd like to see it made public.
We have a number of calls and emails. Several of them have to do with the ordination of women and the status of women in the church. I think Barbara from Severna Park has a comment in that regard. Barbara, welcome to Midday with Archbishop Laurie.
Thank you, and thank you, Archbishop Laurie. My question really is a three-part question, which is, do you continue to support the exclusion of women from the highest positions of power in the church? What the basis in doctrine and in Jesus' teaching is for that? And do you not think that the continued exclusion of women from those places of power will continue to lead to this type of behavior by a certain segment of the priests that that come into the fold? And wouldn't it be better if there were women priests that could be a part of your colleagues and your discussions in your community?
All right, thanks for the call, Barbara.
Thank you, Barbara. Number one, there was a phrase in your first part of your question that I think we need to examine, and that's to think about being a bishop or a priest as a position of power. I think that fundamentally has to be rethought. I think that's what you call clericalism. Am I guilty of it sometimes? Of course I am. Is it a problem in the church? Of course it is. We're taught that all the baptized are equal, and we are taught by Pope Francis that sometimes bishops and priests walk in front of the people, sometimes in the middle of the people, and sometimes behind. And he is so correct about that, a fundamental rethinking. Second thing, what I am for is what I can do, and that's to promote women to positions of responsibility in the life of the church and support those who have been so promoted in other institutions. For example, the Chancellor of the Archdiocese of Baltimore, Diane Barr, head of Catholic schools, Donna Hargens, head of Notre Dame of Maryland, head of hospitals, head of schools. Some of our parishes are run by women. Most of my colleagues are women. Most of our pastors share responsibility with women. It's a question of sharing responsibility. In terms of doctrine, the teaching of the church is simply that we're following the example of the Lord in whom he chose. And will this, in turn, if we made this change, lessen the possibility of sexual abuse in the life of the church? I think that is actually a speculative point. I don't think we know that.
Elizabeth Letourneau, who is at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and runs the sexual disorders clinic at Hopkins, has done research in this and notes that many more men abuse children than women. The number of the percentages are 98% to 2. It's not that no women ever abuse children, but it's 98% of the men are abusing or abusers are 98% male. As a practical matter, perhaps there is some evidence to suggest mm-hmm. that if men were supervised in a different way, if they were not required to be celibate, if they were allowed to be married, if they had other relationships that were more generally socialized, that it would in fact directly impact and attenuate the number of cases of abuse. One of the suggestions that Elizabeth had, which I thought was interesting, is as a step forward, as a reform, would the Catholic Church consider, or would you consider, funding research in that very regard, funding actual scientific peer-reviewed scholarly study about what the effect of women ordination might be, and women in the kinds of positions that the priests and the bishops are in, not just in the positions that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. First of all, we have done some scholarly study. You might remember the John Jay report. The John Jay College of Criminal Justice did an extensive study of this. It was called Causes and Contexts. And it reviewed the history of sexually abusing priests from 1950 forward. It was a big cohort of people. I think that it did not yield exactly the conclusion that you have described. I do think, though, that it has led us to do extensive screening of anybody who is a candidate for priesthood. We have learned to spot warning signs. You can't spot it exactly, but to spot the warning signs. And I would say the other thing is that since the charter and the norms, really beginning in the 1990s when we began to address this, the number of cases have dropped off to a trickle. The most of the cases, and this does not make them any less horrific than they are, most of the cases we have been dealing with have been from the 50s, 60s, 70s, early 80s, and it began to drop off once we began to address it and to root it out of our ranks. Is anything perfect or fail-safe? No. Have I gotten complaints against women employees? I have. I don't think there is any fail-safe approach we can take to this.
See if we can sneak in one more call before we go to a break. Tom in Hagerstown, welcome to Midday with Archbishop Laurie.
Hello. I'm glad to be on. I was thinking in terms of Elizabeth's comment that women in the clergy and married clergy have never been a problem in other denominations, and they are part of the history of the Catholic Church in the very early days. It seems to be the low-hanging fruit that could be a change that might be worthwhile in the Church, and it is really not contradicting the actual history of the Church. In addition, Jesus never said one word about same-sex relationships, nor did he say anything about premarital relationships. These are other things that I think that the Church can address and can be a little more forgiving about and possibly get themselves a little more in tune with the way people think nowadays.
Okay, thanks for the call, Tom. I appreciate it. So again, the doctrinal justification for excluding women from the sacrament of ordination.
First of all, I want to thank the caller for his comments and make another comment, and it's this. Oftentimes, the Church's teachings are conceived and understood in such a way as to present a kind of a wall, as a kind of a block. What Pope Francis has taught us to do, even in areas where there is disagreement, and the Pope must surely know there's a lot of disagreement in this Church, is simply to walk with one another, to try to understand one another, to try to see where we can bridge differences and minimize our differences. If you speak of, for example, same-sex attraction, the first thing the Church teaches us is love and respect. The second thing the Church teaches us is what the purposes, the God-given purposes of human sexuality are, not drawn from one specific text, but from really the whole witness of the Scriptures and the tradition. Same with women priests. No, there's not a proof text that can be found anywhere. We don't have a secret blueprint hidden in the archives of the Vatican. What we do have, however, is the example of what the Lord did. It's not just what he said, it's what he did. And secondly, the relationship of Christ to the church as bridegroom to bride. And the church has always seen that marriage of Christ and the church as something definitive. Does everybody agree with this? No, of course they don't. Does this delight the ears of everybody in our current cultural situation? No, it does not. Is it wise for us to throw the baby out with the bathwater? Probably not.
Got to take a break. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Baltimore Archbishop William E. Lorry. When we come back, you can join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the Catholic Archbishop of Baltimore, William Lorry. Archbishop Lorry has led the Archdiocese of Baltimore since 2012 after holding leadership positions in Washington, D.C. and Bridgeport, Connecticut. Last week, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops met here in Baltimore. They were prevented by the Vatican to issue a statement about clergy sexual abuse. The Holy See called for a postponement of any action till after a global meeting of bishops, which is set to take place in Rome in February. Our number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Archbishop, we have a number of emails and a number of calls, and we'll try to get to some of them. I want to give you one tweet from Liz, who says, "Sex abuse crisis in the church is a symptom of voices missing at the table. Per retiring high-level U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops staff member Linda Hunt, does the Archbishop agree that the future of the church depends on the five theses, including women as decision makers?" And the five theses, for listeners who are not familiar with it, is a group of five suggestions for reform in the church, put together by a loosely organized group of women in the Washington, D.C. area. I understand that Liz on Twitter is one of those. Another is Alice McDermott, a wonderful novelist who happens to live in the D.C. area and is a practicing Catholic. They talk about full transparency, releasing the names of clergy who have been accused of abuse, and pledge to fully cooperate without question and without qualification the investigations. There's survivors' voices. They talk about creating and publicizing a permanent and prominent place in every issue of every diocesan newspaper, including people who can talk about their situations without naming themselves. Simple living. They say to dismantle clericalism, which you alluded to, and to even shed the royal raiment and regalia of the episcopate. You know, don't wear the fancy vestments, but a simple cassock and surplice will do. Put women in charge of leadership. Ask the Pope to restore women to the ordained status and pray for a reformed church. There are other groups that have other lists of suggestions. I mean, how do those five theses strike you?
There's a lot to talk about there. And some of those things are underway. And some of those things could be underway more intentionally. Transparency, people at the table, listening to the stories of victim survivors. I've done it myself in private a lot. I've laughed, cried, wept, empathized, tried to listen. It's very important that those voices be heard. One of the things about the Pennsylvania grand jury report is that it brought to our minds and hearts what this really is, how bad it really is. And sometimes when people speak of their experiences, it comes home to you that we're not just talking about statistics. We're talking about people and about people who have been harmed and in ways that are grievous and serious. Having transparency, the Pope is calling us all to simple living. Not sure I'm going to give up the mitre and the crozier just yet, but I would just have to say that there's a lot to talk about there. And I do not reject these things out of hand. There's a dialogue in Rome going on about women deacons. Let's see where it goes. Let's see where it goes.
Does the fact that, for example, there are around 80 current Catholic priests who were ordained originally in the Episcopal Church, who were married and often have families and then converted to Catholicism and are practicing as Catholic priests now, does that fact, the fact that there are some married Catholic priests, for example, inform a decision about whether or not other priests could marry in any way?
It certainly does. Celibacy remains the rule for what we call the Latin Church, the Western Church. Nonetheless, as you rightly remark, there are exceptions. And so former Episcopal priests who become Catholic and they're married, we have them in our archdiocese, and there are good co-workers. Could the celibacy rule change? It could. Will it in the foreseeable future? I'm probably not banking on it, if I could put it that way.
Liz asks.
And why would I say that? Because I believe that there is something about the congruence of being a priest and living celibacy as Jesus lived it. Not a perversion of it, not a compromised version of it, but living celibacy lovingly and fruitfully. Some people say to me, don't you get lonely? Yeah, don't we all get lonely sometime? More often than not, my problem at the end of the day is getting a moment alone. And I feel, a lot of people say they're married to their jobs. I truly feel I'm married to my ministry, and I draw life from it, and hope to God I give some life to it myself.
Liz McCloskey goes on to ask if you will take these five theses to the retreat that the bishops are having next month.
Sure, be happy to.
Let's go to Mary Ann in Maryland. I'm not told where in Maryland, but Mary Ann, welcome to Midday with Archbishop Laurie.
Fine, thank you very much. Archbishop, one thing that really confuses me and sometimes enrages me, my question is, why are these men who have been found to be abusers of children and adults, why are they not in jail? Why do we not prosecute them?
Thank you. It's a good question, and I've gotten that question a lot. What we do and what we have done for years in the Archdiocese of Baltimore, we turn them over to law enforcement. If it's prosecutable, they get prosecuted. That's not our decision to make, but there have been priests who have been prosecuted and put in jail, and I believe that we're all under the law. And so it's not our decision, but it's not for want of cooperation on our part.
This crisis of clergy sex abuse and the secrecy that surrounded it, the cover-up that you yourself have admitted that many of your colleagues have participated in, is so overshadowing everything else that the church is doing. Mm-hmm. When one looks at the record of the Catholic Church in terms of its social activism, in terms of its advocacy for the poor, in terms of its pastoral mission, those kinds of things, hasn't this greatly attenuated? Hasn't it greatly harmed the church's ability to do those things that people traditionally thought the church should be doing? This crisis is not something on the side. This is at the heart and soul of the institution of Catholicism.
I think that this sexual abuse strikes at the heart of any family, any institution where it is found, because it is such an awful thing. What I'm finding among Catholics is certainly outrage, anger, dismay, but also an intentional desire to carry on with the mission of the church. We educate 25,000 kids. We serve 500,000 meals a year to the poor and homeless. We are helping immigrants we are helping jobs. We are helping seniors. We are the largest source of social services in the state of Maryland. We have to continue our ministry.
Can you continue to do that ministry if there is such a lack of trust and credibility when it comes to how you have dealt with something and which so many, many children and adults have been terribly harmed?
Credibility is something you have to continually build and rebuild. And it seems to me also sometimes the words don't work, but the witness of charity does. John Paul II used to speak about a charity that evangelizes. And so, yes, there are people in the church who have sinned and sinned grievously. That has always been the case. The church is always a cauldron of saints and sinners, and some who have sinned grievously. Nonetheless, the mission is not mine or yours. It's the Lord's. It's the Lord's work we're doing. And we're not doing it simply on our own because we're good people. We're doing it because the Lord enables us to do this. And woe to us if we don't do it.
Just have about a minute left, Archbishop. We have a bunch of emails. One of them comes from Richard, who says, many Catholics in the Archdiocese applaud your announcement of plans to create an Archdiocesan Pastoral Council, the members to be lay Catholics to serve in an advisory capacity in all church matters in the Archdiocese. Again, this has to do with accountability. He's got a much longer message, but he's asking about a timetable for that and about your impression of the credibility of the church as it stands now at this moment.
Okay. Early next year, Pastoral Council, it's on the drawing board. Early next year, we hope to implement. And discussions and work is underway to do just that. Do I think that this has affected the credibility of the church? Of course I do. Of course I do. Do we need to work hard, pray hard to restore it? Yes, we do. And the way you do that, I have found, is by not being defensive, not touting all the stuff you've tried to do to address this crisis, but mostly listening to people and taking the further actions that need to be taken in accord with those conversations.
Well, Archbishop, I appreciate your taking the time to have a conversation with us this afternoon, and we will be in touch. I'd love to talk to you, for example, after the Synod in Rome in February, and we see what comes out of that. We're delightful to have you back and talk more about it.
Thank you, Tom. Happy Thanksgiving.
And happy Thanksgiving to you as well. Archbishop William Laurie is the Archbishop of Baltimore. We've got a link to the Archdiocese website at wypr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's What You Got Cooking Thanksgiving edition. Midday gourmand John Shields and Chef David Thomas join us with tips on stuffing and trussing your bird and this year's In Vogue veggies. Plus, it's Midday with My Mom. We're going to talk holiday confections with longtime restaurateur Sasha Wohlhandler and my mom, Rosemary Hall, who is visiting us from hot Atlanta, Georgia. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. I'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is coming up next after a break for news at the top of the hour. On behalf of the entire Midday team, thanks for listening. Have a great day.